The Guardian.
Support for this podcast comes from Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes creating a professional website for your business, personal brand, or portfolio so easy, it's newsworthy. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
This is The Guardian at the Edinburgh International Book Festival 2014. Here's books editor Claire Armitstead.
Can it really be a whole year since we on The Guardian Books Desk shut up our London office and headed en masse up to Scotland? Oh yes, it can. And this year's Edinburgh International Books Festival promises to be bigger and buzzier than ever, with headliners ranging from George R.R. Martin and Haruki Murakami to the stars of this first introductory podcast, Judith Kerr and Matthew Neal, whose appearances in the first weekend, both together and apart, will showcase the festival's two strands, for adults and for children. But first, joining us now is the festival director, Nick Barley. Nick, tell us a little bit about this particular festival. Obviously, you're in the middle of a momentous period for Scotland in particular. You're in between the Commonwealth Games and the referendum.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, it's an extraordinary time to be in Scotland. It really feels as if the eyes of the world are upon us as the Commonwealth Games has just come to an end, and with the referendum just around the corner in the next few weeks. And it seemed to me that the point of literary festivals is to reflect the way the world is. So, of course, our programme is full of discussions and dialogues about these kinds of topics, what they throw up. And the Commonwealth Games in particular, you know, why is the Empire still in our faces in the shape of the Commonwealth Games, and what does it mean to us today? And then with the referendum, how can we deal with Scotland's future, and how can we talk about it in a way which doesn't leave us divided after the referendum?
And what will this hold for those of us who are not Scottish? How are you going to make this not seem like a sort of introverted conversation?
Well, that's a really good point. We're an international book festival. There are hundreds upon hundreds of international authors coming from all over the world to talk to us. And of course, whilst in Scotland there's a feeling that the conversations here are international in their importance, the really important thing for me is to try to place discussions about Britain in an international context. And so we've got writers who are talking about the Middle East and the problems there. We've got writers from South Africa, from South America and so on, from Australia, New Zealand. So it's really a big international conversation. I think literary festivals are extremely good at dialogue, and by what I mean by that is that literary festivals are about listening as well as talking. Books are about readers as well as writers, and literary festivals make that connection between the two parts, which turn books into an experience which is about learning something. And I wanted to focus on dialogue in particular, because I worry that political discourse in particular at the moment is too focused on rhetoric, on individual politicians stating their point of view. And there's no real sense in which we can have a dialogue about the future. And so it's not just Scotland's referendum, but political conditions overall, the Middle East in particular, in these days. It seems to me that we need dialogue to try and find a way forward.
And that is a particular strand, the Middle East strand, which you've mentioned, which is curated by Raja Shaheda, is it?
That's right, yeah.
Tell us a bit about him and also about the other strands that you've got.
Raja Shaheda is a Palestinian lawyer, famous for his books about walking through the West Bank. I invited him to talk not just about the Israeli-Palestinian situation, but about the conditions in the Middle East as a whole, how the area became the way it is, how it was carved up after the First World War, importantly, what it's like to live there and write there now, and then to ask what might the future of the Middle East be. So it's a series of five discussions with writers from across the Middle East region, from Kuwait, Syria, right through to Egypt, and of course Palestine as well. So the idea is to try and zoom out from individual zones of conflict, such as Syria or Egypt or Israel and Palestine, to look at the bigger picture.
And lest people fear that this is getting away from a literary festival, you've also got one of the strands curated by the Booker longlisted novelist Ali Smith. You bingoed there, didn't you, Nick?
I love Ali Smith's work, and I'm so happy that her new book is on the Booker Prize, Man Booker Prize longlist, How to Be Both. It's a fantastic book, and she'll be talking a little bit about that. But I also invited her to talk to other people for whom writing really matters, literary people, such as Jackie Kay, the Scottish poet. And she'll be talking with Jackie about an Orcadian film poet called Margaret Tate. She'll also be talking with international writers such as Lydia Davis, who won the Man Booker International Prize last year, wonderful American short story writer, and with Margaret Yule Costa, who's a literary translator, to talk about how the act of translation plays a creative part in how we read novels.
She's in conversation with Gillian Beer, which I was really interested by. What sort of a conversation is that going to be?
They've known each other for a long time, and they've got a huge amount of respect for each other. Gillian Beer is the great literary critic and academic. And really, they're going to talk about how being a literary critic feeds back into the writing process. So as much as being an interview with Gillian Beer, it will be a conversation in which Ali describes how literary critics such as Gillian feed into the work she does, so how she learns from the critics. So it's a kind of dialogue between two parts of the way in which literature comes together.
Tell us about some of the other more unexpected strands that you've got. You've got something going on sponsored by the Wellcome Foundation, haven't you, about talking with voices, hearing voices.
That's right. It's called Conversations with Ourselves. And it comes back to this question about dialogue and about how we write and how we read. And the question is about how we hear voices. Voice hearing has traditionally been regarded as something which is slightly problematic or psychopathological. When perhaps the act of reading and the act of writing novels might require us in some way to sort of to imagine voices in our heads. And so we're doing a project together with Durham University in which we tried to turn it into an experiment. We're going to ask novelists to tell us what voices they hear when they're writing their novels. And then later we're going to ask readers to tell us what voices they hear when they're reading novels. So this turns into a whole series of discussions with novelists and also with voice hearers, some of whom have been regarded in the past as schizophrenic, to try to look at depathologizing the voice hearing that I think perhaps we all have in some way or other. It comes back to things like imaginary friends. Children very often have imaginary friends, and some of them think they can hear those imaginary friends for real. Other people have said they've had a religious epiphanies and they've heard voices, and in some cultures that's regarded as being incredibly positive. So why is it that in this 21st century Western culture, hearing voices has too often been regarded as just as a problem? So it's really kind of an exploration of a way in which we imagine and in which we understand novels.
So that's the festival as a research tool, in a way. You'll be putting your resources at the disposal of Charles Fernyhough, it is, isn't it, who is a novelist and sociologist, isn't he?
That's right, exactly, yeah. So it involves interviews with a number of different authors from various different parts of the literary world about how they put together their novels. And for me, I'm really delighted that a literary festival can be about this aspect of how writing takes place, you know, the actual process of writing novels. I think we're the first literary festival to ever attempt such a thing.
And then there's another departure for you, which is that you're going into live performance, aren't you, with a fully staged dramatisation of letters.
What a leap of faith that was. But I'm really proud of the result. Again, it came back to this idea of dialogue. How does dialogue work in novels? Well, that's the bit, isn't it? With the inverted commas, that's the words that writers put into other people's mouths, the voices of the characters. And I started to think about how we read those voices. Then I thought about theatre, and dialogue in theatre is a hugely important part of of theatrical performance. So I thought, how about if we commission some short stories in which the dialogue then gets adapted into theatre and see how it looks on the page and compare it to how it feels on the stage. And so, four short stories, Chimamanda Adichie, Kai Miller, Christos Tsholkos, and Kamala Shamsi, those four short stories have each been turned into a short piece of performance, of theatre. And it comes together as a kind of, like an anthology of short performances, which add up to a whole production. And it's an astonishing piece of promenade theatre. And alongside that, we've published a book of the original short stories, so people can see the theatre, read the short stories, and see how different they feel, how the dialogue is different between writer and reader, and between performer and audience. So I think it sounds complicated, but the result is this exuberant, gorgeous piece of theatre which I hope people will see, and with any luck, it will tour beyond Edinburgh in the future.
Why is it called Letters Home, then?
Well, it starts out, I tried to think of how we could really
play on this idea of dialogue. And I thought letters are a perfect piece of dialogue in which you've got people at a long distance from one another, and with dialogue playing out over time. So because there's time in between each communication, there's a possibility for misunderstandings and betrayals and kind of dramatic developments. And so the only brief to my writers was to write a piece of epistolary fiction, which means fiction in which takes the form of letters. So each of these short fictions is a series of letters between one character and another, in which the plot develops through their letters to each other. So it's letters home. And then, of course, I realised that letters home starts to have people who are musing about what it's like to be away from home, what it feels like to be at home or away, and starting to think about things like coming back to the Commonwealth. What does it mean to be part of a union of countries which may be falling apart or which may be changing over time? And somehow home and away seemed pertinent to that.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace. When you need to know what's in the news, you turn to The Guardian. When you want to create something newsworthy, you turn to Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it easy to create your own professional website for your small business, online store, professional portfolio, or blog. Getting started takes only seconds. Just go to squarespace.com, and to support this podcast, use the offer code GUARDIAN to take 10% off.
And with that, we'll move on to a dialogue between mother and son, and not just any mother and son, but Judith Carr, creator of the feline superstars The Tiger Who Came to Tea and Mog, and Matthew Neal, the Whitbread award-winning novelist who's just moved into non-fiction with his latest book, An Atheist's History of Belief. Welcome, Judith and Matthew. Now, both of you are appearing in two events in the opening weekend, and you're doing one separately and you're doing one together, and it has the wonderful title Mother and Son on Creative Inheritance, which I gave a loud whoop of joy at hearing because it entitled me to ask you all about what you mean by creative inheritance. Matthew, not only have one writer parent, your father was also a very distinguished writer, a screenwriter, wasn't he? So you had a sort of double whammy.
That's right. And in fact, my grandfather, he was a writer as well, and even my father's father was, he wrote short stories.
Your father was Nigel Neal.
Yes, Nigel Neal, the screenwriter.
Judith, was there a time at which you knew that Matthew was going to be a writer?
Well, he never said, but we did know that he was a bit odd that way. I mean, don't often hear your six-year-old daughter jump up and down in great excitement because her three-year-old brother is going to tell her a story. I mean, it was extraordinary. He was making up stories almost as soon as he could talk.
Did Judith show her work to you? Was that very much in the family?
They began to appear when I was a little bit too old for any. But I remember that when Hitler Stole Pink Rabbit appeared, when I was just the right age for that, I'd say.
You did two volumes of memoir, Judith. Was it two or three?
Three.
When Hitler Stole Pink Rabbit, it tells about your family having to flee Germany as Jews during the Second World War, which is also part of your creative inheritance, isn't it?
Certainly, because of my father, who was a writer. The picture books were really the result of having been with my children when they were picture book age. And so I had an idea of what they would think was funny, and it was a creative inheritance the other way round, in a way, because I would never have done the picture books if I hadn't had the children. I mean, they inspired me to do the picture books. Pink Rabbit, I did write with the idea that I would like them to know what it was like when I was a child, because it was so different from their childhood. So it goes both ways. I don't think my father got anything off me in the way of creative inheritance, but I certainly got a lot of inspiration from him. And Tom, of course, Nigel Neal, who was known as Tom, I learned so much from him. I mean, I'm not basically a writer. I just picked up a whole lot from him.
You've said that to me before, and I don't believe it. Do you believe it, Matthew?
No, not at all. No, no, of course she is. But she's over-modest, you see.
Is this something that you really, really believe?
It's something what I really, really believe. I mean, I can do it, and I work hard at it. But the only thing I've ever written are the novels, which are based on something that actually happened to me and my family. I did try to write a novel and I spent 18 months on it. It was a total waste of time. I couldn't do it.
And yet, when Hitler stole Pink Rabbit, you write fantastically evocatively about what it was like to suddenly find all your neighbours not wanting to talk to you and not really understanding.
Well, I remembered it, that's all. I think half the trick with writing is if you have something to write about. Most people can write about something that happened to them. Matthew writes about things he invents. He invents worlds, and that's proper writing, as Tom did as well.
I think the thing is, even if you've experienced it, you still have to make it into a story, and you were very good at that. So I think you're definitely a proper writer, no question. Well.
But also I want to challenge you about that on another front, which is The Tiger Who Came to Tea is a fantastic piece of writing. It's a whole world you've conceived through the characters in that picture book.
That was sort of wrought from me by this little face in bed wanting to be told something, you know.
I thought you were going to say you knew a tiger once.
We did look at a lot of tigers in the zoo, and that was part of the inspiration. We were a bit fed up because it was a bit boring, and we wished somebody would come. You know, it'd be nice if somebody came to tea because Tom was out filming, and it seemed a good idea that it should be a tiger, that's all. You see this child and you try to please it, as I always did.
Matthew, moving on to your book, your subtitle is...
It's an atheist history of belief, understanding our greatest invention.
And who is our greatest invention? Or what is our greatest invention?
Belief, I suppose.
Not God.
I would say God, gods, religion, but also some other notions we came up with which aren't exactly religious, but nevertheless are kind of imagining our world. So, I mean, I look at a few other things as well, such as Marxism, which is it's a bit similar to a religion in many ways. It's also constructing a kind of a structure, if you like, constructing a structure of how you imagine the world to be with a set timeline, a sort of past hell and a future heaven and a sort of exploding moment. It's all rather... you can really compare Marx and the Book of Revelation. They're rather similar.
You waded right into it, didn't you, with these... You've took on all the sort of power bases in contemporary culture, atheistically speaking.
Well, I wanted to understand what people had believed and maybe have a few guesses as to why at different times people came up with very different ideas. So... I mean, as far as the book has a notion in it, it's really that at different points, religion is a direct mirror of what people were most worried about at the time. So naturally, the gods change according to what people were most scared of. So 30,000 years ago, they were scared of not being able to find animals to hunt. 8,000 years ago, they were worried about their crops not growing and bad weather and... If we were living in a very sort of intensely religious time now, people would probably have gods of bad traffic jams or delays on the tube or internet down.
You write, from earliest times, every religion has given people comfort by offering ways, so their followers believe, always that caveat, of keeping their nightmares at bay.
Yes.
And it just struck me that there's a... Coming back to the family... theme, your family emerged from a nightmare, didn't it? Or
yes.
Judith's family did.
Yes. No, and I think that's one of the reasons I was interested in all of this. Is I look at some of the strange beliefs that grew up in the late 19th and early 20th century, which were a kind of background inspiration for Nazism. I knew nothing of Judaism, so I was also curious about that. And also curious at the origins of anti-Semitism, which I was surprised to find occurred much earlier than you'd think. They occur in the first century AD, long before Hitler came along.
You say you know nothing of Judaism, but Judith, you're Jewish.
Yes. My father was brought up in the Jewish faith and thought it was wonderful, but when he was about 20, he decided he really didn't believe in God. And so we were brought up without religion, but very much with Jewish ethics. Tom didn't believe in God, so there was no religion in our house.
Although we had Christmas trees.
We had Christmas trees, yes, but we had Christmas trees even when I was a child.
There was Mog's Christmas. Mog had Christmas.
Mog had Christmas. Everybody has Christmas.
You have written 7 novels, I think, and I always remember the review of English Passengers, which was the one that won the Whitbread Prize. There was a review in my own section in The Guardian, which opened Bring Out the Bunting.
Yes, <that's
laughs> it's such a brilliant piece of phrase making. This is a very serious subject and your first non-fiction book. Does this mark a change of direction for you?
Maybe. I mean, I'm writing another novel at the moment, so I certainly don't want to stop writing fiction. Yeah, no, I very much enjoyed writing non-fiction, and I'm an obsessive researcher anyway, so it wasn't as big a jump as I thought it might be in some ways. Also, I think there's something strange in that if you write a novel and you then want to write another novel, you have to sort of forget, you have to sort of decompress, and it takes a while to get rid of the previous novel. Whereas non-fiction and fiction don't seem to sort of impinge on one another. I was actually writing the two things side by side. It's as if they don't really worry each other. Whereas writing two novels at the same time would undoubtedly lead to madness.
Do you have various other things on, various different things on the go, Judith?
No, I don't, but everything I do always means two different things, writing and drawing. And mostly, I think, I write just enough to be able to draw. I'm doing something at the moment which I've never done before, which is one of those in-between books of about 60 pages between picture books and a proper novel. And I have to write rather a lot. And I'm writing a bit and then doing the drawings, you know, drawing on every page. This is why I said I'm not really a writer. It's quite clear to me that all I want to do is the drawings. And I say, oh, God, I better write another bit. And then I'd be able to do 12 more drawings.
So you're an artist rather than a writer, is what you're saying?
Oh, yes, much, much, much
more. And that
more.
Was your training, was it?
Yes, I went to art school. I've always drawn since I can't remember when I didn't draw. I missed a whole lot of it because I spent 5 years working for the BBC. I did write then, and then time with the children when I didn't work. And I feel I'm desperately catching up on those 12 years now and just drawing and drawing all the time. I just want to draw.
And am I right in saying that you have all your drawings, original drawings, in your house?
They're in that place in Newcastle, seven stories. Yes,
I think when I saw you, when I came to your house, I think they were still in your house.
They were in this awful chest, plan chest, which was collapsing. And you know, I didn't know anybody would want them because it's quite recent, really, that illustration has become an art. It never used to be. It used to be just something people did, and they were paid a lump sum for by the publishers. It's only, Seven Stories said they would be interested in it, that I discovered that this stuff I had, which I just kept in case it was needed for the printers, was actually of interest to anyone. It's very, very recent. My friend Peggy Fortnum, who did the original drawings for Paddington, she started about 10 years before I did, and when she did that, I think they just paid her a lump sum for the drawings and kept the drawings. I mean, obviously it's my publisher, so they've done all sorts of things to make up since. But that's how it was in the 50s. In the 60s, you got royalties, which was big stuff.
Mm-hmm. You'll be talking, of course, on this Saturday with a star of the new illustration generation, Lauren Child.
Oh, well, she's wonderful. I mean, she's a sort of genius. But I was talking to her, and of course she writes these brilliant books as well. And she was saying what I used to feel when I wrote the novels. Whenever I'm writing, I wish I was drawing. And whenever I'm drawing, I wish if only I were writing, because it always seems so difficult.
Thanks very much to both of you for coming in.
Thank you.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace. When you need to know what's in the news, you turn to The Guardian. When you want to create something newsworthy, you turn to Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it easy to create your own professional website for your small business, online store, professional portfolio, or blog. Getting started takes only seconds. Just go to squarespace.com, and to support this podcast, use the offer code GUARDIAN to take 10% off.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.